It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This weekend's targeted shootings of state lawmakers in Minnesota has renewed concerns about political violence and security for elected officials. The alleged perpetrator had a long list of possible targets, including Senator Tammy Baldwin and 10 other Democratic elected officials in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin State Senate Sergeant-at-Arms announced additional security measures for the state capitol yesterday, and Attorney General Josh Call provided this statement. Quote, my thoughts are with those affected by the horrifying events that occurred in Minnesota. Political violence is an attack on our democracy, and it is imperative that we wholeheartedly condemn it in any form. He went on to say, as information about this incident comes to light, we must evaluate what it means for security needs and whether any changes need to be made.
We're getting reaction to those attacks and what they mean here in Wisconsin. Kieran Doyle is a researcher with the Wisconsin-based nonprofit, the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data, which tracks political violence in the U.S. and around the world. Kieran, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Mordecai Lee is professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former state legislator from Milwaukee. Mordecai, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me.
Mordecai, you followed, of course, Wisconsin politics for years. You represented Milwaukee in the state legislature in the 70s and 80s. Did you worry then about violence against politicians while you were serving, and what have you seen change over the years?
You know, it seems so long ago, but in the 70s, when I was in the assembly, there was a group called the Posse Comitatus, a very right-wing, militant, armed group. And believe it or not, they threatened to hang me. And I really didn't know what to do with it. I mean, I wasn't going to ask for security. So I just shrugged it off, although the sergeant-at-arms took it a little more seriously. But then in the 80s, when I was in the state Senate, one day I got a phone call from the FBI saying that on a wiretap, they picked up some threatening language against two people, and I was one of the two. And that the FBI told me they didn't think it was particularly serious, and they weren't encouraging me to take any particular steps. But I've got to tell you, it sure seemed vivid, and I'll confess that within a few weeks, we got a security system for our house just because of that threat.
And Mordecai, state lawmakers, other elected officials do sadly get death threats, and I think often maybe shrug them off. But that concern, what if, and as we saw in Minnesota, what if this one is the real deal? Is that something that you think nags at elected officials every day, maybe?
I really like your point, Rob, that just like police take any any telephone threat of violence at a school or a bomb threat of violence at a school seriously, they never, ever say, that can't be true. There's a long shot that's going to happen. They always take it seriously. And so what I'm afraid is that that exact approach is now going to have to be taken by state legislators and by the people who are in charge of security. You can't take anything as, just an empty threat.
Now, Kieran, you research and you track political violence, your group around the world and here in the United States. When we look at data about violence against politicians in the U.S., what kind of things are you seeing?
Thankfully, it's the case that violence targeting political officials in the United States has remained rare in recent years. And while that's a good thing, it's also extremely troubling to still see it happening today. On the other hand, while violence against elected officials is quite rare, some data collected by a partner organization of ours, the Bridging Divides Initiative at Princeton University, speaks more to what you were discussing before, which is threats and targeted harassment against elected officials. Their data shows that we've seen more than 600 incidents of threats and harassment against local elected officials in 2024 alone, which was a 14% increase from the previous year. So that's definitely something that's a major factor in how people experience political violence in these elected positions. And it might have a chilling effect on many people's willingness to do the job, to take risks while doing the job. And it's definitely a major cause for concern in the political violence landscape in the United States.
Kieran, we worry sometimes about organized groups. Mordecai mentioned the Posse Comitatus from back in the day. But it seems like a lot of the attacks we think about, the ones this weekend in Minnesota, the congressional baseball attack in 2017 targeting Republican federal lawmakers, were by individuals motivated by ideological reasons, it appears, in this case in Minnesota, still waiting for details. How much do you distinguish between an organized group threatening or committing violence versus that one individual inspired by a political motivation?
That really gets to the heart of one of the major trends that we're concerned about in the United States, especially over the past couple of years. You're right that organized political violence involving extremist groups has been on the decline in the last 3 or 4 years in particular. This was a major concern that many people had ahead of the elections at the end of last year, that our data was showing that organized extremist violence was increasingly rare. And that remains the case till today. However, at the same time, as you've said, we've seen a rise in political violence carried out by individuals, not only the person involved in the shootings this weekend, but also, for example, the person who was President Trump's would-be assassin in Butler, Pennsylvania last year, as well as slightly more obscure incidents, like a man who blew up a fertility clinic in Palm Springs, California last month. So from this, we're seeing that the bar has really never been lower for individuals to carry out acts of political violence in the United States. And that's a major concern, not only because they may be ideologically motivated, as you've referenced, but also because in many of these cases, the ideologies that the individuals hold are quite difficult to understand, and they're not clear to law enforcement or to researchers even months after the fact. Or they may be political ideologies that are far outside the mainstream. Far outside the mainstream. For example, this man who committed the bombing in Palm Springs was related to natalist beliefs, which is not something that is discussed more widely. So that makes it very difficult to track where threats might be coming from for law enforcement, not just because individuals are more difficult to track than groups, but also because they have to have so many different possible types of ideologies on their radar that may motivate people to commit political violence. So that's a really difficult and concerning trend that we're tracking.
Mordecai, there's a sense, I think, in the country that we are hyper-polarized more so than at any time, at least in recent American history. What do you think? Is there something to that? Do you worry, if so, that that contributes to the risk of violence?
Well, there's no doubt that there's an intensification. But I think when we talk about past examples, very few people remember the death threats that Senator Barack Obama got when he started running for president in 07 and then was a candidate in 08, that there was just a wall of threats of people saying, we will never permit a black man to be president, to live in the White House. And he had to get Secret Service protection way early. It was even before the Iowa caucuses. And I remember so many people telling me things like, I don't have to worry about voting for him because he's never going to be alive to make it to the White House. I've got to tell you, I heard a dozen people say that to me. And so that was very real, and that has not that has faded from memory.
Kieran, something you just mentioned, the idea that these targeted political attacks don't fall along sometimes predicted political lines. And sometimes when we see an attack, we want to, I think, categorize it as left against right or right against left or whatever. You mentioned it can be less known, less widely known, and talked about ideologies. Does it make it harder to, I guess, predict, anticipate, and maybe prevent political violence when it does happen?
I think there's certainly an element of that. I think it poses a challenge for law enforcement trying to track certain ideologies to predict where attacks might be coming from. But you're right also that despite the fact that many of the ideologies of the people who carry out individual acts of political violence are quite obscure, these acts of violence nonetheless have a polarizing effect on our national conversations around these acts of political violence. directly after, for example, the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, many different political figures were discussing and assuming the ideology of the shooter in that incident, which is something that remains quite murky still to this day, and is even in places contradictory. So while it poses challenges for law enforcement, that doesn't necessarily make its way into the conversations that we have about these acts, and they can still therefore contribute to this perhaps bigger picture polarization in the country.
Mordecai, when we have a tragic attack, as we just had this weekend in Minnesota, what do you want to hear from political leaders across the political spectrum?
I want to hear, first of all, nonpartisanship. And I want to hear a sense of comity, that we're sort of all in this together, as opposed to, well, maybe those people are under threat, but my people aren't, or whatever that might be. And it has to be taken seriously. But I think what I'm fearing is even an overreaction. Let's say that every member of the Assembly and Senate were to be assigned a bodyguard. Now, what does that mean for, I don't know, in the summer, so many legislators would go to church picnics and church fairs and festivals and shake hands. Are they supposed to walk in cautiously, carefully, with a bodyguard clearing the way for them? This would undermine the sense we have in Wisconsin that our elected officials are just an arm's reach away, and that they're our neighbors and our friends. Having a bodyguard changes the sense of the moment.
We'll leave it there. Mordecai, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Kieran, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a million.
We've been talking to Kieran Doyle, researcher with the Wisconsin-based Armed Conflict and Location and Event Data, and Mordecai Lee, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former state legislator, looking at political violence in Wisconsin and around the country after this weekend's targeted assassination in Minnesota.
Coming up, legislation to increase the ratio of apprentices in the trades. Hear both sides.
It can bring people in that want to learn or anxious to learn, that want to change the tide of diminishing workforce.
It doesn't make sense for me to have two people standing there watching me. We have to be hands-on. We have to still be getting stuff done while we're trying to train these people.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A bill in the state legislature would allow apprenticeship programs to increase the ratio of apprentices to journey workers.
State law only allows a journey worker to instruct one apprentice at a time. The bill would allow two to one.
Several labor unions oppose the bill, raising safety concerns. Some business groups support the legislation.
We're checking in with skilled tradespeople on both sides of the issue. Jeff Disher is a master electrician and owner of Disher Electric in Stevens Point. He's former board chair of the Associated Builders and Contractors of Wisconsin. Jeff, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff, why do you support expanding the apprenticeship ratio in Wisconsin? What should that do for your business?
Well, you know, sometimes it ain't all about me, but it's a look in the eyes when I tell someone that, hey, we just don't have enough skilled guys because we're one-to-one. That I can't put you on the apprenticeship this year. You can work for me, but you can't go the apprenticeship. And, you know, and I think the tide has changed where not everybody wants to go to college. Everybody's realizing that there's money to be made in the trades, that you can have a great job. You don't have to be stuck with large bills of student debt that drag you down for years and years and years, that there's an ability to make good money and go into a trade and have a long-term career that can carry you through your lifetime.
What is the distinction there between you can come work for me, but you can't go the apprenticeship route? What is the difference there?
The difference is that you're going to school, you're getting paid to go to school, you're learning through the curriculum that is written through approved trade school that is done mostly at the tech schools. All the trainings are done at tech schools at this time. And you're learning both the written and the on-the-job type learning. So,
how much of a need is there for you to train more apprentices? What is demand like?
So right now, approximately 41% of the construction workforce is projected to retire by 2031. The need is great, and that's actually from a Center for Construction and Education Research statistics that's been put out. The need is great. I mean, there's going to be a skills gap in there that, because of the talk of having to go to college and kind of demoralizing the fact of going into trades for so many years, that the skilled people that are in the skilled trades are going to be retiring, and there won't be that person to train someone and that pass their gifts along, you know, in that trade. So,
are you having trouble keeping up with the demand for your services?
At times we do. Yes, we work a lot of overtime and put a lot of stress on the guys to try to make sure that they're, you know, we're trying to keep up with projects and stuff like that. There's a high demand. We hear all the time, fair, your wages, I mean, your fees are fair for what you provide. And it's, you know, I believe that the demand is not going to go away, and it's only going to grow because of all the people that are moving into the area that we live in and stuff, and are going to be shopping and living in our areas with multifamily building up and everything. So,
you mentioned the trade school book learning, but what goes into training an apprentice electrician on the job?
So on the job, they're actually monitored through their process of, you know, being with someone that is skilled and taught. You're being taught, and a lot of people that we bring in now don't have a lot of times the hands-on, so we have to be with them quite a bit, trying to put them in positions that they learn through repetitiveness and are watched thoroughly through the process or whatever by the skilled person, that journeyman or whatever, and that to pass that along. But it's really a process that they grow steadily through that. That first year is really difficult. Then they just seem to start clicking, it does and stuff. But not all these kids that come out of high school and everything that are actually hands-on. So they have to get a lot of knowledge in that first year to start to take off and grow in that. So,
thinking about the job site, though, are there certain, I don't know, complex or difficult procedures that you carry out as a master electrician that you would never teach with a higher ratio than 1-to-1?
Well, there's always standards. An apprentice is not allowed to work on live, let's say, live circuits at all. We try not to work on live circuits no matter what. But there are times that you must or whatever, but for the most part, we try not to. But they are never allowed to. An apprentice is never allowed to be in a live panel, let's say, or anything of that nature. So they're not allowed to do certain things that would put them in any harm's way because of their lack of skill or whatever, and that they haven't built up yet. So,
how well do you think an electrician could train two apprentices at the same time?
I was, I did some, when I testified in Madison, I took statistics of, universities, and what University of Madison has 28 to 33 students per professor in a classroom. I know that's different, it's not hands-on, but you're talking architects, whatever it may be, engineers that are designing buildings, and they're teaching these multi students in there and have, you know, and that is actually accepted where we're not able to train more than two. I think it's very easily for someone to work with two. Sometimes it's actually nice for that person not to be intimidated. They have someone that works alongside of them that has the same skill set and gives them that you know, feel of comfort or whatever, knowing that, hey, we're kind of working side by side. This other man or woman is watching over us and training us. And we have this, you know, kind of a level playing field with two people, let's say, in the room or whatever, that are at the same skill set.
We're talking with Jeff Disher from Disher Electric in Stevens Point about a bill in the legislature that would allow journey workers to train apprentices in a 2-to-1 ratio instead of the current 1-to-1 limit. Jeff, why do you think labor unions, including the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in Wisconsin, oppose this bill?
Well, I don't want to speak to that, speak about them too much. I want to kind of, they do their thing, we do our thing. We try not to get in their business. We try to leave them alone. But most a union, actually, and it was brought up in when I was testifying, that most union electrical trades, I think I speak to, is are training at 3-to-1. We're trying to go to 2-to-1, and we are. That's all we're asking for is 2-to-1. Most unions are training at 3-to-1. I don't believe our skilled guys are any less skilled, so I'm not sure why we wouldn't be qualified to, but they're saying that we're not at this point. I'm not sure why that would be that way. So,
but electricity is high stakes. I mean, there are no do-overs with electrocution. And I know you said that these apprentices aren't working on live lines or a live panel. But does that fact cross your mind at all?
Oh, always does. We are always taking safety as a top priority. We have safety manuals we follow. We have safety inspections. I've got a couple of plaques behind me of safety awards that we've had. That, you know, in 2024 we had zero accidents in our business. You know, 20 guys in the field and we have zero accidents. I feel that's pretty good, something to boast about. So that is a priority number one, is safety on ours. We have also, ABC has, I believe, five full-time safety inspectors that come out, that are paid to come out on our jobs and actually inspect us through these processes and that, and we utilize them. So.
And ABC stands for
Associated Builders and Contractors. Sorry, yes.
No, that's okay. Thank you for that. Before I let you go, Jeff, do you think this is an issue that is more important for smaller contractors and family-run businesses versus the larger construction companies in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I believe it is. You know, when you're trying to get ahead in apprentices, it's very difficult when it's 1-to-1. You can train one, but let's say it's one journeyman. Let's say you're a master electrician, you are, and it's just you, and you hire one, you put him through the apprenticeship. You now have to carry him for 4 years before you can add your next apprentice. You know, and those are the companies that are being stifled the most, the ones that are smaller, that are, you know, just your mom and pops, or that young man or woman that says, hey, I want to become a contractor and grow my business. I have this drive in me to grow. They're being stifled and stopped, and their energy is burned up. They can't find these people out there. They're not making a journeyman on a daily basis that you can, you know, just grab and take. So it's very difficult. So to grow is always going to be very difficult for somebody that is smaller. So,
Jeff, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
That is Jeff Disher, a master electrician and owner of Disher Electric in Stevens Point. He was with us to share why he supports a bill in the state legislature that would allow for a greater ratio of apprentices to journey workers. Now we're turning our attention to the labor union groups who oppose this legislation. Andy Buck is director of governmental affairs for the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 7, which includes Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He's also a 24-year member of Glazer's Local 1204. And Heidi Utronka is a four-woman painter for Common Links Construction in Brookfield and a member of the IUPAT Local 781. Andy and Heidi, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us today.
Andy, why does your union oppose this bill that would allow for more apprentices to be trained?
Well, thank you for the question, Kate. As somebody myself that spent 18 years in the field as a glazer, you know, we know that mentorship and one-on-one in the construction industry is the safest for our members and for our contractors. So somebody that, you know, talking with their folks, they, you know, have been saying the same thing. Wisconsin, as you know, started apprenticeships in 1911, and we're so proud of that model and want to continue the tradition and of what we've been building here in the state of Wisconsin. So, we just from talking to our members, we know that safety is the number one issue here, and we're going to listen to what our members have to say.
Heidi, what goes into training an apprentice painter? What does that look like from start to finish?
It's pretty extensive. I mean, we try to do our best. I personally over-explain to them, but I mean, you're coming from, when I came in, I never even set foot on a construction site. So I was very green. These kids, they don't know. I mean, they're very green. They don't know anything about it. Some of them have never been on, you know, a site before, and it's overwhelming, and it's a lot. I mean, we put a lot into them.
Andy, how well are your workers able to meet the current demand for skilled labor? Is there a need for more apprentices to be trained?
Oh, thank you for that question, Kate. The worker shortage thing keeps coming up. I would say in the unionized construction world, all the trades from plumbers to insulators to roofers, we have people that want to join our ranks. I think our main issue is not a worker shortage. It's a placement of responsible contractors. We don't have enough responsible contractors to like a Common Links to put apprentices at. So that, it gets talked about a lot of worker shortage, but we have a list of, a lot of folks that want to join our ranks. We just don't have responsible contractors to put them at. In Wisconsin, you have to have a sponsor to become an apprentice. And so contractors, we're so proud of our joint labor partnership. Our contractor partners will put on the apprentices, and then the union will train them.
What do you mean by responsible contractors?
Well, contractors that invest back in their workers, that have great health insurance, retirement plans, and pay great wages.
Heidi, do you think you could handle training two apprentices at the same time? What might be the challenges there?
So I'm currently on a 5-story building, and you don't normally, you're not always just in one area. You're all over this building. I mean, like even today, I have 5 people here and I'm one of them. So it's like every time I'm trying to show somebody something and I get them going, then somebody else calls me to do something. So if I'm trying to train two apprentices at once and I'm trying to run a crew of guys, like how am I supposed to show them when here, you stay here by yourself because I have to go do this and help this other person. So it's not a well balanced for me to train them because I'm not there with them, where I should be with them. If I have two people just standing there watching me, I mean, that's not productive for us either. Then we're losing money. And then our contractors are like, well, what's going on? Why is this? Why is that? Why aren't we making the jobs? Why aren't we making the hours? Well, because I'm trying to train two people at once. So you're paying for two people to watch one.
You're trying to show techniques, you're trying to demonstrate, you're trying to give feedback when the apprentice then takes over. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yeah. You want to be with them. You just want them to watch you so that they can replicate what you're doing so that they can do it by themselves. But if I'm trying to, it doesn't make sense for me to have two people standing there watching me. We're not in a classroom situation. We're on a job site. We don't have an overhead projector or whatever. So here, watch this all day long. We have to be hands-on. We have to still be getting stuff done while we're trying to train these people.
Andy, what might be the consequences for your union and its workers if this bill were to pass?
Well, I'm going to go back to safety being paramount. And, Heidi was referencing the job site conditions. 96% of an apprenticeship spent on the work site. Only, 4 to 5% are spent in the classroom. So our apprenticeships are anywhere from 6,400 to 7,400 hours in 3 to 4 years. And so when, you're on a dangerous construction site, and like Heidi referenced, she's on a 5-story construction site right now. There's a lot of moving parts and pieces there. We want to make sure that our folks are safe and they're learning from their journey workers.
We have heard that Michigan is able to make this work, having a ratio that might be 2-1 or 3-1. What is your response to that, Andy?
A great question. Well, I think we would like to be more like Michigan right now. Michigan has repealed right to work. Michigan has reinstated prevailing wage. Michigan has invested in unemployment insurance that bumps up to, I think, $600 a week, where Wisconsin is the 10th lowest. You know, there's a lot of good things that Michigan is doing. And, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I think the original ratio was brought by the Walker administration. So, you know, from our opinion, that we want to keep our job sites safe and let Michigan do what they do, and Wisconsin being the leader in apprenticeships, we're going to continue to do what we do here.
Heidi, what is the difference between a skilled painter who is well-trained and one who isn't? Can you talk a little bit about the contrast?
So when you're not well-trained, I mean, these are the guys that are more likely to get hurt on the job, for one. I mean, the second thing is these guys are laid off. If you don't know what you're doing because you didn't have the right proper training, you're laid off for 6 months a year. So maybe you're working a half a year. So what's the benefit of that?
Well, Andy and Heidi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening to us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kate. Thanks for the time.
Andy Buck is with District Council 7 of the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades. Four-woman painter Heidi Utronka is a member of the IUPAT Local 781 in Milwaukee. They oppose a bill to expand the apprentice-to-journey worker ratio. Earlier, we heard from master electrician Jeff Disher of Stevens Point, who is among the bill's supporters.
Coming up, fans of a much-loved and unique store are rallying to keep it open. Meet the owner of American Science and Surplus to find out why.
It's part of a community. It's bigger than just being a store.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the past decade, there's been more momentum behind the land back movement. That is where Native tribes try to regain their ancestral lands.
In one of the latest cases, the state of Illinois returned land to the Prairie Band Potawatomi that was illegally sold nearly 200 years ago.
Harvest Public Media contributor Peter Medlin reports on the growing land back movement in the Midwest and the different ways tribes actually get their land returned.
Raphael Wawusik drives through Chief Shabanoff Forest Preserve in northern Illinois. He's a member of the Prairie Band Potawatomi's Tribal Council and a direct descendant of the chief, whose name the Prairie Band pronounces Shabni.
If this is accurate, that this was the site where his cabin was, then within a few hundred yards, you know, I've got some family members that are buried out in these woods here.
The Prairie Band were removed from Illinois in the 19th century, and their reservation's now in Kansas. But in 2024, the federal government put land the tribe purchased in trust, making the Prairie Band Illinois' first federally recognized tribal nation. And this year, they got even more land back when Illinois passed a law transferring ownership of the neighboring Shabanaw Lake State Park to the tribe.
You know, my family have been coming up here for almost the 2 centuries since we've been forced out. And to see that happen in my lifetime is something that I thought I would never experience.
Recently, other Midwest tribes have successfully gotten land back through various means. Just last year, Minnesota returned a state park to the Dakota tribe, and Congress passed a law returning land to the Winnebago in Iowa. Kevin Washburn served as Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs in the Obama administration and is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. And he says that while the movement has gotten more public attention lately, it is not new.
Tribes have been wanting their land back probably since before the ink was dried on the original treaties where they ceded that land.
And tribes lost even more land after the Dawes Act in 1887, which broke commonly owned reservations into individual parcels. In the allotment era, about 65% of reservation land fell out of Native hands. And today, tribes own around 60 million acres across the U.S., which is about the size of the state of Oregon. And while some have had land returned by states and the federal government, Washburn says that is not the norm.
The most common way that tribes get land back is they go out and buy the land.
Many tribes have made buying land back a priority. Nicole Rummel is with the United Nations Land Management Department. They're a tribe just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
In 82, that's when the tribe approved every carton of cigarettes being sold, 30 cents of that went to land acquisition. So that's really what started money going back into being able to buy land.
They now operate a casino as well, and they've been able to purchase back nearly half of the reservation land they lost. But tribes can face other challenges even when they can purchase land. In 2023, when the federal government put 500 acres of land the United Nation owned into trust, a Wisconsin village sued in part because of lost tax revenue. The case is in federal court. And sometimes people take advantage of how important it is for tribes to restore their homelands. Matthew Wiesaw is the tribal chair of the Pokagon Band Potawatomi, which has land in Michigan and Indiana.
One of the biggest difficulties is when people find out it's the Pokagon Band that's looking to purchase the land, the price gets really jacked up. So we have to deal with that. So we have to do a lot of stuff under the cover of different entities.
Wiesaw says they don't buy land just to buy land. They focus on sacred places like old villages, historic sites, and burial grounds. And back in Illinois, Raphael Wawusik looks out across Chabanaw Lake, which was once part of a Prairie Band village. And even though the tribe was forced off this land so long ago, he says he still feels a strong connection to this place. His family always has.
For me, I didn't need the piece of paper to really drive that home. That's something that has been instilled in me since I was a young boy, that this is part of our home as well.
And as the land back movement picks up steam, he hopes more tribes will be able to return to their ancestral homes. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Peter Madlin.
Hector Alejandro Arzate contributed to this story. Harvest Public Media is a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest and Great Plains, including Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today. The quirky sundries store, American Science and Surplus, launched a fundraiser late last month as a last-ditch effort to save the store. Thousands of supporters have given to save the 88-year-old retailer.
American Science and Surplus, with its eclectic mix of odds and ends, ranging from telescopes to tactical sporks to Romanian army gas masks, has three locations in Wisconsin and Illinois.
Its biggest location is in the south side of Milwaukee. That store has been open since the 1980s. Fans see it as a local institution, but it's facing some financial challenges. Like a lot of retailers, competition from chains and online stores has cut into sales, and the store faces a short-term expense with the need to find new warehouse space.
Last month, owner Patrick Meyer created a GoFundMe page to raise funds to keep the business afloat. In less than 3 weeks, the company has raised more than $160,000 to cover moving costs and to update the store's website. Patrick's goal is to raise $200,000.
Patrick Meyer joins us now for a look at the past, present, and future of American Science and Surplus. Patrick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
For people who haven't been into the store, can you walk us through the doors of American Science and Surplus in Milwaukee? What are we going to see?
It's a hodgepodge, a mishmash of all different kinds of gadgets and gear and DIY stuff and STEM-related science projects. And there's teacher stuff. There's military surplus. We've got a little bit of everything and not a lot of any one thing.
And can you give us the origin story of American Science and Surplus? Got quite a history.
The company was founded about 88 years ago by our original owner, the Liebers, who were digging through a dumpster in the back of a warehouse and discovered some lenses and decided to throw them up in Popular Science magazine. They went over real well, and that's how the surplus end of things began. They kept collecting and collecting and collecting. Early 40s, we opened up a store on the northwest side of Chicago. That kept growing in popularity, and in the early 80s, we opened our Wisconsin store. Also opened up our third store in Geneva in the early 90s. So that's kind of how it came about.
Now, there's something about this store that captured your attention at 16 to the point where you eventually became the owner. And this is something I hear from your customers, from people in the Milwaukee community. I assume the same is true in the Illinois stores. People feel a connection with this. What is that about? What is bringing people like you and so many others to make this a long-term experience?
Well, it's kind of like what you just said. It's part of a community. It's a bigger than just being a store. Employees, they really create a atmosphere, a fun atmosphere, and they help with projects. The customers, who we call our SERPies, the SERPies help us with projects. They help us help other customers. There's a big DIY community. You know, because we're so family oriented, it's generational. You know, parents bring their kids, then their kids bring their kids. It's just been a long-standing love affair with our customers. They participate. They don't just, you know, they just don't come in and shop. They participate in helping each other discover, you know, whatever project that they're into, whether it's DIY or whether it's STEM or, you know, maybe it's a science fair project. Maybe it's for Halloween. They're making a Halloween decoration. A lot of times in the store, you'll see customers talking to other customers about their projects and helping each other out. And it's really a community.
We are talking about the American Science and Surplus stores in Milwaukee and Illinois. Patrick Meyer is with us, longtime employee, now owner of American Science and Surplus since 2012. Challenges facing the store, though. And Patrick, now you've got this GoFundMe aimed at supporting the store. What are some of the challenges? What are some of the headwinds that have put you in this position?
We ran into some financial troubles after COVID. It's been kind of a consistent downward trend for us a little bit. We were hoping by making some changes to our website and doing some different events at the stores, we could really, you know, bring folks back in. But it became difficult after COVID. People got used to ordering online and ordering on Amazon, you know, the online part of the business. We did well during COVID, but as COVID kind of wound down, then so did our online business. And then at the time, the stores were still pretty closed. And it took them a long time to recoup. And in the meantime, it put us kind of in a financial bind. And towards the end of last year, we didn't have a particularly good year last year. So we decided that we needed to move the warehouse. We've lost our lease and we need to move the warehouse. And that's like step one. And we didn't have the cash flow to do so. So we've asked our SERPy community to try and help us out. And so you know, more generations can experience American Science and Surplus and be part of that community.
Now, you put up this GoFundMe with all everything you just mentioned in mind. What kind of response did you get from your supporters?
It was incredible. I can't thank people enough. They've really gone above and beyond what I was expecting. But, you know, we didn't have really any expectations. I didn't know what to compare it to. Over 3,000 people have donated to it, and I couldn't thank them anymore. Sometimes it's hard for me to talk about because having people care that much about the business that that you've built, the community that we've built together, it's difficult to talk about sometimes, but it's just been incredible the support that we've received, both verbally, you know, in the retail stores. Milwaukee has done really well since we started the GoFundMe. They've had a lot of people just come in and purchase stuff, or they wanted to donate in person. So they come in and they buy something above and beyond the price that we're asking for it. So I can't thank everybody enough.
Looking through the comments of the people who gave, a common theme I saw came up pretty often was people saying, hey, you know, going here as a kid kind of inspired my interest in science and engineering. Whether or not they went into those fields at all, it was an earlier exposure to the world of science and technology that obviously for some people stuck with them. Is that something you've seen over the years?
Yeah, it happens a lot. And engineers typically will reach out to us and tell us, you know, that American Science and Surplus has helped them with their career goals. Started off as American Science and Surplus, building something out of the materials and motors and blowers and pumps that we have. Right as this whole thing, as we launched, we got an email from one of our customers who had a tattoo of Jarvis, which is our mascot, on his forearm. And his email message said that, you know, the reason why he got into engineering is because of American Science and Surplus. And then he tattooed our logo on his arm. I can't believe that people really love American Science that much. It shows how much our employees care and how much there is a community out there for people.
Now, American Science and Surplus, you got three of them, right? You can't go to any community in the United States and find another one in the chain. Do you see some value in just having cool, distinct local businesses in a community that you're not really going to find in another place?
I hope so. It's going to be a horrible world if there's just Amazons and Walmarts and Targets for people to shop from. The strip that we're in Milwaukee has two other small businesses that we hope that people stop by them after they stop by us, kind of thing. Losing a community, losing a local small business is tragic. And some only make it a couple of years, but some have been around a long time. And to have any one of them go out of business and is really tragic. It's kind of the fiber of America is all these small businesses that we were built on small businesses, and to have any of them go out is bad. To have small communities lose something that they grew up with is not good.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And again, support your local business whenever you can. They would really appreciate it.
Patrick Meyer is the owner of American Science and Surplus. The 88-year-old store has three locations in Wisconsin and Illinois. The biggest store is on Milwaukee's south side. The store recently launched a GoFundMe page to raise funds in order to keep the business afloat. As of this morning, the store has raised more than $169,000 with over 3,000 donations. Their current goal is to raise $200,000. We just heard about a unique store with a devoted following in Milwaukee.
And we want to know, do you have something like this where you live? An unusual, a quirky, or otherwise special local business that all the locals know about? Maybe it's a place that sells spare parts or random vintage things.
A place where you could say, yeah, they only have that here in our town. You can't get that anywhere else.
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can also call or text us at 888-642-0232. Once again, that number, 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Courtney Everett, Lauren Cox, and Trevor Hook. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.